Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Greetings. This is Paul Holdengraber, your host for The Quarantine Tapes, brought to you by Onassis LA and Dublab. I am thrilled to announce that we have asked various former Quarantine Tapes guests to host, during a week, guests of their choice in total freedom. They have absolute carte blanche. This week I have asked the wonderful writer Walter Mosley to serve as our guide and guest host. I do hope you will enjoy Mosley's choices for this week on The Quarantine Tapes. Thank you so much for listening.
Good morning, Morgan. How are you today?
I'm great. Feeling very optimistic.
I want to thank you for agreeing to be a part of The Quarantine Tapes. As you know, your friend and mine, Paul Holdengraber, has asked me to cover a week of this, his essential podcast. He let me choose the people I wanted to talk to, and you, Morgan Intrigan, were way up on my list. Being CEO and publisher of Grove Atlantic Press, you've been in the business of publishing for nearly 40 years. It is my opinion that publishing is an indispensable part of American and international culture. Indeed, it is a vertebra in the backbone of American self-knowledge. Books are the foundation of modern human thought, creativity, and even our souls. Grove Atlantic is an independent press and therefore liberated to master one of America's greatest gifts, that is, the freedom of speech. I'd love to talk to you today about your history and experiences, along with something that has occupied my thoughts for many months now. Looking out of my window here in Santa Monica, I have often found myself thinking about the current and unique plight that the pandemic has oppressed and provided us with. People are dying by the hundreds of thousands. Many are out of work and thrown out of any familiar rhythm of normality that existed before the tsunami of COVID-19. This pandemic, in my opinion, is not only the virus, but also the struggle for racial equality, an American fight that is older than America. Along with that, we are living through an extraordinary political revolution where most citizens feel that they have to get involved in order to have a world they can see themselves in. All of that, and I look out of the window and think that this time has the potential to make us stronger, smarter, and more in touch with who we are and what we might become. In other words, I wonder if there can be any shred of optimism in these times. How can we make better selves and a better world when every step, every breath we take can spell disaster? This is the question I have for you, Morgan. Is there any hope, any optimism we can garner in these trying times?
Well, that's a very thoughtful and articulate introduction, Walter. This morning we're getting the results of the Georgia Senate races. And when I woke up early and saw that Raphael Warnock, that the AP had declared him the winner, that gave me tremendous feeling of hope and optimism. And at breakfast with my 14-year-old son, I got married for the first time late and became a dad late. So I talked to him about growing up in the South, and I was 14 in 1969. And I think that those late 60s, you and I are the same generation, was a similar kind of inflection point. And those times formed me and made me who I am, and made me choose the career path and that I did. And to see my 14-year-old engaged and keeping a positive attitude, though he is, you know, unable to see friends. He goes to school twice a week in person, but his political engagement and his the fact that he cares so much about these things gives me hope. So, you know, it's a big question. The where are we with politics, with cultural discourse, with the media, all of it. But, you know, through it all, I do feel optimistic somewhat. And, you know, we could try to parse it down to where does the optimism come from? You know, I think that as a publisher, you have to be an optimist. I set forth commissioning books and publishing books, you know, every month, every week, every year. And most of them aren't going to find as large an audience as I would like them to. But some of them do. And some of the books, the audience comes to them years later. But I never have lost my optimism about publishing. And I still love it and bring it to work every day.
And one of the experiences I know that you've had that you and I mean, everybody in your immediate family has had COVID-19 there in New York. That's right. Right. How does that impact how you're feeling, what you're thinking? Well, that's pretty hard for you.
Yeah, I got very sick in March. I came down with the symptoms on March 11th. My son and my wife, Rachel, my son, Alan, my wife, Rachel, were sick within a day or two. Alan, the symptoms weren't bad. Rachel, the first week, was sicker than I was, but she got better and I got worse. And on March 19th, I went to the hospital. They said I wasn't sick enough to be admitted. On March 22nd, I went to the hospital. Within 45 minutes, I was in the ICU. Mm-hmm. I got out 4 days later. I immediately had to turn to what was happening with the lockdown of the various businesses that I oversee, and had to apply for the payroll protection loan. I remember spending 7 or 8 hours on a conference call with my accountant, my banker, my lawyer, at my elbow, my 14-year-old, who was my tech advisor, because as a significant shareholder and CEO, I had to do all of it myself. And as for those of you who know me, tech is not exactly my strength, but fortunately, it is my 14-year-old strength. And so
he built a computer, didn't he?
He built computers for Grove. That was his summer job 2 years ago. Because I was talking over dinner about we were going to buy some new computers. He said, "What are you getting?" And he said, "Can I talk to your IT guy?" And my IT guy said, "He knows more about this than I do. We should let him do." And so, yeah, he's impressive. But I'll tell you, I was very sick, and a friend said, "Well, were you scared?" And I, of course, when I said goodbye to my son going to the hospital, I was so sick, and I didn't want to scare him, but I knew I might not see him again. And then when I had to leave my wife, she rode over in the ambulance with me, but she could walk to the front door, but she couldn't come in, and I knew I might not see her again. So, but once I was there, I thought, well, you know, I mean, honestly, I thought I've lived a full life. I've been very, very lucky and privileged in my family and in my profession. And if this is the way that I go out, it's the way I go out. But it's made me very grateful and made me appreciate more than ever. And I hope I always have been grateful for what has been given to me and this luck and success that I've had. But this underlined it. And what it also did, frankly, was make me start to try to think more about the future. You know, Grove Atlantic is a kind of unique. It's both a unicorn and a dinosaur, as I say. But I didn't start it. Atlantic Monthly Press was founded in 1917 out of the magazine, and Grove Press, founded by the great Barney Rossett in 1951. And my hope is that it can continue as an independent publisher after my professional life and even after I'm gone. So, but I know in order to do that, I've got to plan for the future. And I have great team here and a great group of young people. And we are, and that was, you know, I had seen, you know, my friend and mentor and colleague, Sonny Mehta, passed away in December. Mm-hmm. The head of Knopf, the greatest publisher of our time, I think. And but I see other peers and contemporaries and people half a generation older, Peter Mayer and Michael Kruger, the great German publisher, and others retiring or moving on or passing away. And so, and I think that that kind of underlined it. So, but I'll tell you the one thing about getting COVID early on is we all three have very strong antibodies. And as a result, we've been able to move through the world a little less anxiously over these last months. So we still take precautions, wear a mask, wash our hands, socially distance, et cetera. But there is a slight silver lining there because, you know, I know in your mid-60s as a male, you're a prime sort of target, and you have to be careful. But I have been able to move around with a little less anxiety about that. But I don't know. I feel like the whole COVID thing has been, it's an inflection point like those late 60s, early 70s were, like Kent State, Watergate, you know, all those times. And America came out of that in some ways better. And I think we woke up about certain issues. We didn't get woke enough. And when I look back now, I mean, that was 50 years ago. And how could we have made so little progress in those decades? But this feels like a similar inflection point. And well,
go ahead. It does feel like that. I think. Yeah. And also it feels, I mean, this, our experience, usually technology and I'll call it, you know, how technology is systematized grows greatly in times of war. And this experience, as far as I can see, is kind of like a world war, even more like a world war than the first two that we had, because everywhere in the world, people have to deal with this. Our technology is advancing, the use of our technology is advancing, who we are. And I was wondering, along with that, how publishing itself has gone with you while you're, you know, having COVID, being careful about COVID, all of that. But you're still a publisher. How's the business going through that?
Well, I mean, interestingly, people are reading more, it seems. And I think it's because they, you know, they're locked down and they can't go out to restaurants and they can't go to the movie. They can't go to the theater. They can't go to the concerts or opera. They can't travel as freely. And, you know, it's been interesting. I worry tremendously about our one of the great national treasures, which are our independent booksellers, and not only our independent booksellers, but the Barnes and Noble, the big national chain, Hudson, which, you know, is at the under the leadership of Sarah Hinckley over the last decade or 15 years. If you've noticed, the bookstores in our airports are superb bookstores that offer a tremendous selection. And, you know, I think it how rich that is and how it enriches the experience in there. So I've worried about the booksellers. I've worried about our libraries. And I particularly, it's been challenging to get new books started because, you know, we rely on authors being able to do public appearances at lecture series, at bookstores, at libraries, et cetera. So all those things have been a challenge. But I predicted and budgeted for our sales to drop by 50%. In April, May, and June, and then start to come back in July. And what has happened is that it didn't drop nearly that much, and it's taken it's taken longer for them to come back. But also our backlist has performed, and you know some of that comes from the Black Lives Matters movement, the social justice issues that were brought to the fore in May and June. Mm-hmm. And Grove, of course, has been on published some seminal text in that area. Franz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth being, right, you know, one of the primary ones. And I remember one week in June, we sold almost 1,000 copies over Amazon of The Wretched of the Earth. Yeah. And I said, just out of curiosity, could you check last year in June, that first week, how many did we sell at Amazon? It was maybe four. So it was, and, you know, but you know, all in all, it's been okay. I think there's some new books. It's been very challenging to get new books going.
Along with that, you know, I belong to this organization that I helped found called the Crime Writers of America, and Crime Writers of Color, excuse me. And one of the things I know is like I did a couple of tours recently, and both times I did many more events because I could do it virtually. And often I was able to bring along newer writers, you know, who people hadn't necessarily met yet. So we could, we'd be doing an event and, you know, in quotes, in a bookstore, you know, in Ohio or in Florida or in Seattle, Washington. But I could be with other writers who hadn't quite gotten to the level that I am. Has that been working for you at all or not?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that these virtual events, as we call them, have, you know, we're using those as a substitute for the actual events. And I think, mm-hmm. And it's better than, and there's some interesting, you know, positives, as you say. You don't have to get on an airplane to go, right. You know, be in Seattle or Washington or where, you know, wherever that you otherwise would have to go to. But there, it's a different experience. The booksellers put a lot of time and effort and energy into it, and they don't sell as many books. You know, what I always say when an author is going out, particularly, you know, early in their career, or even if they're in the middle of their career and haven't quite had a big level of success, that they get discouraged when only it's a rainy night in whatever city and 12 or 15 people show up. And I said, look, I know that that's discouraging and no one's happy about it, but I'm telling you that bookseller appreciates you making the effort to come there. And the fact that you did and the fact that you were coming makes those younger booksellers and the people out on the floor aware of your book, and they position it at the front of the store, and it helps us perhaps convince the local media to cover the book. And so you are accomplishing things. So and that it doesn't happen at quite the same level with the virtual, but I do believe going forward that there will be a kind of hybrid. There's going to be a combination of virtual and back to sort of, you know, actual physical events. And so that's a positive, but it hasn't, the impact is not quite the same. And, you know, we had, for instance, Helen McDonald, the author of H's for Hawk, which was a surprise bestseller for us 4 years ago, wonderful nature writer. Her new book, Vesper Flight, she was scheduled to do 31 events over a 6-week period. And Helen is a dynamic, you know, reader, presenter, speaker. And we've had good success with the book. It went on the New York Times bestseller list and has sold well this fall. But my guess is that we would have sold at least 30 or 40% more. Mm-hmm. Than we did had she done those 31 in-person events. Yeah. And what happens also, you cut back and we did maybe 8 virtual events because they cannibalize each other. You know, if you're appearing in Miami and DC and Boston, they're all in the same time zone. So, you know, so the booksellers are a little bit leery about being the 4th event in the Eastern Standard, you know, time zone, because mm-hmm. other people might just click on to another event they see. So we've had to cut back a bit and be careful there. So we mm-hmm. try to do, you know, a limited number. But you know, all in all, we made the best of it. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm getting a little sick of Zoom calls, but Zoom is better than nothing. So
yeah, well, Zoom is better than the emptiness. Another question I wanted to ask you more, you know, just about you personally. You're there in New York City. I'm here in LA right now. I'm a New Yorker, but I'm in LA. And, you know, some months ago, New York went through kind of the worst experience of COVID in the United States. What's it like for you and your family living there now?
Well, it's been strange. And I mean, really, next to those, you know, having experienced some of the unrest in the 60s around the civil rights movement and around mm-hmm. the Vietnam War, this is the most sort of impactful, tumultuous moment I have ever experienced in my life. I mean, mm-hmm. the days after the protests around the BLM in May and June, my wife, who's a photojournalist, was out at 3-4 in the morning photographing. I was worried about her, and mm-hmm. but you know, she's covered wars and disasters for 30 years. She knows what she's doing, and the work she got is amazing. I mean, rachelcobb.com photography, you can go look at it, you can see it on Literary Hub and other publications. But so we were really getting, you know, Alan and I were at home, but getting just firsthand reports of what exactly was going on out there. And then you saw the things being boarded up, and you saw, but when she was covering the COVID those first days, she was going out and she went out to JFK and came back and was showing me the pictures. There was no one in JFK. Yeah. some homeless people there. The streets were empty. There were people were drag racing in Times Square. I mean, it was like in you know, at 8 o'clock at night. It was strange because, you know, it's a very lively place, Manhattan and New York City, and it was shut down, and almost out of some kind of dystopic sci-fi movie, you know, Escape from New York or something, if you remember that one from our
youth. Ernest Borgnine. I love him in that. Right. Now that you're, I mean, there's so many interesting things going on, and there's so much negativity because, I mean, people are frightened. You know, they're frightened about COVID. They're frightened about Black Lives Matter and defunding the police. They're frightened about the election, both sides. I mean, because everything is so close. When I'm looking at it, I see, wow, Americans are actually involved. Most, you know, Americans who can vote and even who can't are involved in the democratic process. I mean, some people are trying to demolish it, but regardless, we're involved in it and learning about it. More people know more about the American democratic process now, I think, than have ever in my life. And does that mean anything to you? Are you?
Well, sure. I go back to, you know, just having a 14-year-old at the table is very interesting, you know, and I think we all know more about the Electoral College and its role and the state electors and the legislatures than we, unless you were alive in 1877 or the last time someone tried to challenge this, you know, but I don't know. I mean, I was, you know, to watch these congressmen and women and senators cynically challenge this count today has been, I've never seen anything like that in my lifetime. I think at the worst of Nixon and Spiro Agnew and the other thugs around them, I think that these people have crossed a line that is beyond that. As you saw finally yesterday, another 12 or 13 Republican senators stepping up and saying, you know, I do have an oath to defend the Constitution. Right. And it's like, oh, well, thank you for coming around to that on January 5th. And, I've never seen anything like that. And it's shameful. And these people should be held accountable for their behavior for the rest of their lives. And I hope that it doesn't, I'd hope it doesn't help their careers, because I think there are enough decent people in the middle, either registered Republicans or independents, who will, I hope, take them to task and hold them responsible for this terrible decision that they've been making in these last weeks and days under some kind of, I don't know, strange fear of the thug in the White House. It's a mafia don, you know, or some self-interest of thinking it's going to benefit them to capture his base in, you know, 4 years, the ones hoping to run for president. But but yes, there is an engagement, you know, and there's a level of discourse, and that's what you get, you know. I mean, it's what, when, as the ebooks came in and people said, well, our book's going to disappear, you see, books are changing. The role of books, and Cynthia Ozick wrote a great essay on the centenary of T.S. Eliot's birth that was published in the New Yorker about how central a role books played in her life when she was a college student. And the new Steinbeck novel or the new Hemingway novel or whatever was a cultural event when that was released. And books are not as central to the culture as they were. But, you know, there was a time when opera was central to the culture. There was a time when narrative poetry, when, you know, if you had Lord Byron published a poem and sold 10,000 copies in the first month, you know, it was, so media changes and shifts, but books still remain, you know, at what I started to call them was 100,000 word prose narratives. Mm-hmm. And they still, whatever you call it, and however it's delivered, they remain the repository of the deep knowledge of our culture and our civilization. Yeah. And if you want to understand economics, if you understand history, if you want to understand race, if you want to understand, you know, climate change, etc., you have to, I mean, you can get information from a documentary, you can get information from the internet and from magazine articles and newspaper articles, but a real deep dive is that 100,000 prose, the word prose narrative. And they're still alive and kicking. And they're still, you know, there are extremely impactful books being published around these issues. And they're selling in the hundreds of thousands, even millions of copies. And so that is heartening to a 65-year-old or about to turn 66-year-old publisher. So, you know, and I don't know, the same for fiction. You see the voices and the wide range of voices coming from the non-dominant culture over the last 20 years. That's where the real energy in fiction has been. And that's extraordinary to see. And these books are reaching a lot of people. They're being read and they're being discussed and they're having impact. So it gives me hope.
Well, I definitely agree. I think there's a lot of hope in the world that we're facing. Suppose we're coming toward the end. I'd like to ask you one more question, just because I'm interested in how you're going to answer. When this is over, you know, when there's, you know, herd immunity or enough of the vaccine or the disease just gets tired and, you know, wanders off somewhere. When the doors are open again and life is open again, is your life going to be different than it was before?
Well, absolutely. It already is. You know, I'm standing alone in my 10,000 square foot office at 14th and 7th, and I miss my colleagues. You know, I love what I do and I love coming to work. And I like working with my colleagues, and they're, you know, what they call, I guess, in the tech world, they call them collisions, you know, of just seeing somebody in the kitchen or in the hallway or bopping into their office and brainstorming for 2 or 3 minutes about something. And so I'm going to appreciate that more than ever. I think we're going to appreciate so much more than we ever. I mean, I miss going to the opera. I've loved the opera since my mom and dad turned me on to it years ago. And I had let my subscription lapse, but I'm going to resubscribe and I'm going to really enjoy going 7 or 8 times next season or whenever it does open. I miss going out to restaurants with friends, those simple pleasures. You know, we have a 2 friends that, a couple that also had COVID last spring and also have strong antibodies. And so they're our little pod of who we see. And it's great to see them. And we were, you know, lucky enough to spend a few weeks out on at the beach in Long Island in July and August. And there you could more safely see people. But again, it was mainly just 2 at a time. And, you know, I am a very convivial person, as you know. You've known me for years, and I miss that. And I miss seeing my bookseller friends across the country. We did some virtual events, but usually I would be flying around, hosting lunches and dinners, going to regional shows for independent booksellers, going to Frankfurt for the International Book Fair, going to London for the London Book Fair. And I'm going to appreciate all of that more, and I think we all are. I hope we all are, but I think, yeah, things have changed forever. And, you know, I think maybe some good will come out of it. You know, you see the ways that we live and work, in these crowded urban areas, perhaps there's going to be a little bit more flexibility. And, you know, publishing has for way too long been way too New York centric. And so perhaps we can find a little bit more diversity geographically in that, letting people and hiring people from around the country and realizing that they can work remotely. So I think they're all new models that we can try and new paths forward. And, but the main thing is, I think we're all going to be, I hope, more appreciative of the small things in life.
Yeah. I think it's so true. To have a friend, you know, that you can talk to, you know, to sit even alone in a cafe, you know, with people around, you could just watch them. You may not even be able to talk to them. I think there's without hope, there's no future. And no matter how hard things are, you have to hope. And I feel like that. I've been, you know, working hard and enjoying my writing and, you know, doing some more painting and thinking it's great. Well, listen, Morgan, it's wonderful to talk to you. And I'm glad that you were able to, you know, take some time out of your busyness to be able to do this. And thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk to you, Walter. Thanks for inviting me on. And I look forward to us being able to sit together again at the River Cafe.
All right.
When we're on the other side of this. So take care. Be take careful. Care.
I will.
Okay. All right, man.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.